You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of NYPD Confidential by Adam Sierowski. For their part, Canada's RCMP was running its own undercover, who was monitoring Khalid Hussein, Chowdhury's Edmonton-based personal assistant, who would exchange candid voice notes with his boss, including one he shared with a Canadian agent, describing ITS as being Al-Muhajirun. MI5 provided wiretaps. In the view of law enforcement, ITS was simply ALM in sheep's clothing, and Chowdhury from East London's Ilford neighborhood was pulling the strings. ITS has claimed it as an intellectual group pursuing its struggle through nonviolent means. On July 17, 2023, SO15, MI5, and their North American partners gathered at the Counterterrorism Operations Center in West London. Hussein was preparing to fly from Edmonton to London, so officials put a plan in motion. "We waited for him to get into the air," SO15's commander said, "and sent in a team to do a forced entry at Chowdhury's home. The cleric was taken into custody. As counterterrorism agents scoured the premises for electronics, another team was dispatched to Heathrow to arrest Hussein when he landed. Unlike some of his underlings, Chowdhury demanded a trial. That presented thorny issues. How would Britain introduce evidence gathered overseas by a foreign security service like the NYPD? Were New York's standards governing entrapment as rigorous as those in the UK? This was a case of first impression, and a risky one. A lot of the time, even when UCs are involved in a case that leads to an arrest, we try to, at the very last minute, kind of compartmentalize them so they don't have to testify, because that'll burn them, and then we can't use them as undercovers anymore," Weiner said. "As a result, often a case goes to a plea instead of public proceedings. But we've never had this scenario where you have a trial overseas involving our testimony." In what Murphy called an unprecedented move, Weiner directed 377, after 13 years of undercover work, to testify against Chowdhury, knowing full well that it would blow his cover and end his clandestine career. "I ask her about her calculus in making that decision. For each person who does this work, it's incredibly stressful. It's at times very dangerous. And so there's a shelf life to it," she said. "But there's always the understanding that if the investigations require you to surface, then you will." For the British, and for Weiner personally, Chowdhury had become a Melvillian white whale. She also recognized that 377 had already had some extremely close calls when, at the 11th hour, ITS members pleaded out. "In this case, I think it probably comes as some degree of relief and a great capstone. If you're going to have this career, this is a great way to end it." "I was nervous. I didn't know what to expect," 377 said of his appearance this past summer at London's Woolwich Crown Court. "They make you stand in the witness box. Had I known, I would have worn more comfortable shoes," he laughed. "They cleared the court for me, and there was a curtain. The judge, the jury, and the defense counsel could see me, but Chowdhury couldn't. When I asked how he survived cross-examination, 377 shrugged. Defense counsel didn't want me opening up Pandora's box and doing a lot of damage." Last July, after a 6-week trial, Chowdhury was convicted of directing, being a member of, and encouraging support for a terrorist organization. He was sentenced to 28 years in a British prison. The day after the ceremony, to honor their joint effort, Weiner and I had lunch at St. Ermin's, a legendary London watering hole for spooks, and for moles hoping to glean state secrets. It was clear that, for her, Chowdhury's had been no ordinary case, and that hers was no ordinary job. Her team had not simply taken a shameless, prolific radicalizer, as she phrased it, off the chessboard. Rather, by helping bring about the conviction of a bona fide leader of a terrorist group, they had changed the contours of the game. Weiner was in good spirits, but she was clearly preoccupied. She would later explain, "It was very cinematic. I was literally in the taxi on the way to the awards ceremony when the assassination happened," referring to the sidewalk slaying of Brian Thompson, the CEO of United Healthcare. Then, of course, that's the dominant thing, the anti-corporate tech bro who hates the healthcare industry and has caused widespread panic among CEOs. Her new boss had been calling and texting her to exchange updates throughout the day. So had her federal partners. She was the NYPD's counter-terror czar, and that encompassed domestic terrorism as well. She hadn't had the luxury of fully basking in the moment with her crew. And then her solicitous side kicked in. When a waiter brought me a particularly off-putting gluten-free entree, a cylindrical cauliflower steak, she insisted that I eat her meal, Dover sole, literally handing me her plate. Off and on during lunch, from her tableside seat in Westminster, she kept fielding calls from New York, excusing herself at various points. When I asked how she juggled it all, assassinations, bomb plots, not to mention her family, social life, and New York City politics, she answered in signature fashion, "I feel like a qubit in quantum computing. We have to exist in two different states as the same person at the same time, and that's just the ever-present reality of this work at this moment in time." Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis. Brooke Shields. The actor and author of Brooke Shields is not allowed to get old on Princeton Pride, her dystopian idol, and lying about your ugly baby. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Watching my girls laugh together. It is more short-lived than I'd like, but it does happen. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Fame. On what occasion do you lie? I really don't like to lie. I will withhold petty truths if they'll hurt someone's feelings, or if someone has an ugly baby. What do you dislike most about your appearance? That I feel I should have to care about my appearance. What are your favorite names? Mom, babe, asshole. What is your greatest extravagance? Vintage jewelry and finding treasures that I don't need in antique shows. What is your greatest fear? Drowning. The feeling of not being able to take a breath. I'm sure my therapist would have something to say about the deep psychological reasons for it. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Boudica, the ancient queen. When and where were you happiest? On a beach, watching my girls do cartwheels, with a Goombe smash, with a floater on top. Which talent would you most like to have? Playing the piano. What is your current state of mind? Optimistic. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I would erase my fear of dying, but I suppose that would be erasing some of my human condition. Which living person do you most admire? Gloria Steinem. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Going to Princeton. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? Not that this could be changed, but I wish my dad were still alive. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Impatience. What is your most marked characteristic? Loyalty. Or that I'm not pretentious. People are constantly shocked that I'm a normal person. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Lying. What is your favorite journey? The one I am currently on. Perpetual growth and nurturing. Which living person do you most despise? Anyone who profits off those less fortunate. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? This too shall pass. What is your greatest regret? Having regrets. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My children. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? Shaquille O'Neal. What is your most treasured possession? My dog, Tuzi. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Fear, or the DMV, which are often synonymous. Where would you like to live? London. What is your motto? Never give up and keep growing. What is your favorite occupation? Comedy. Anything I can do that has comedy. What do you most value in your friends? Humor. Laughing with my girlfriends is one of my great joys. Who are your favorite writers? Michael Cunningham, Abraham Verghese, David Sedaris, Agatha Christie. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Katniss Everdeen. Who are your heroes in real life? My business partner and the COO of my company, Carla DeBernardo. What is it that you most dislike? Feeling not good enough and chia pudding. How would you like to die? Really old, but with all my marbles, or if not all, most. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Brooke Shields. the power and the glamour, portraits of the artists and visionaries pushing Hollywood forward in times both dark and bright. A portfolio by Norman Jean Roy, styled by Deborah Afshani. Michelle Yeoh, the icon. 2 years ago, she made history by becoming the first Asian woman to win an Academy Award for Best Actress in a Leading Role. Today, she's captivating audiences as Madame Marable, the Grande Dame of Wicked. Yeoh's genre-smashing career has spanned Hong Kong action films, the Bond franchise, and the hit rom-com Crazy Rich Asians. It's no wonder she commands every room and scene she's in. Gwyneth Paltrow, the tastemaker. A whole generation has grown up since Paltrow won her Oscar for Shakespeare in Love. Now the hugely influential titan of Goop is returning to film in a major non-Marvel role for the first time in years. Starring in the Safdie brothers, Marty Supreme, opposite Timothée Chalamet. It's a testament to Paltrow's ability to do anything and everything on her own terms and look better than the rest of us while doing it. Julio Torres, the eccentric. If you've seen his A24 comedy-drama mashup Problemista with Tilda Swinton, or his surrealist plot-defying HBO series Fantasmas, you know why Torres, along with the likes of Cole Escola and Sarah Sherman, is leading a new generation of comedians blurring the line between humor and performance art. He may live in Brooklyn, but Hollywood has taken notice. Aisha and Stephen Curry, the Renaissance couple. Aisha Sweet July started as a lifestyle brand built on the heels of her culinary success. It has since expanded to books and film production and opened its first location outside the Bay Area at the Regent Santa Monica. Stephen's Unanimous Media has a global talent partnership with Comcast NBC Universal to produce original content. The entrepreneurial spirit was passed down by Aisha's mother, and that tenacity inspired Aisha's husband when the couple moved up the coast for the Golden State Warriors. You have more control of your narrative, Stephen says. You're building things that have more meaningful impact and ownership for the long term. It's way beyond basketball now. Jonathan Anderson, the secret weapon. After conquering the fashion world with his namesake label and as the creative director of Lo, Anderson is coming for Hollywood. In 2024, he served as costume designer for Luca Guadagnino's captivating movies Challengers and Queer with his I Told Ya t-shirt, from the former becoming a social media phenom. Rumors of his continuing ascent abound, so it's quite possible he'll be onto a whole new chapter by the time you read the sentence. Alex Prager, the illusionist. For decades, Prager has made photographs so cinematic they explode off the walls of the gallery and exist as their own mini-worlds. Now she's directing a feature film starring John C. Reilly and Elizabeth Banks. Because of my long career in art, I am innately tuned in to those in-between moments, those reflections of life, and I can spot emotional truth when it plays out in front of me, Prager says. Bella Baharia, the green light. Following a shake-up at Netflix, Baharia emerged as the chief content officer of the streaming giant, which serves a staggering 283 million subscribers globally. She's the force driving its expansion into new territories, as well as its live events and sports coverage, while simultaneously overseeing all film, scripted TV, documentaries, reality, comedy, and more. When you Netflix and chill, you can thank her and her team. Issa Rae, the powerhouse. Actor, writer, producer, restaurateur, and author, Rae is one of the busiest forces in Hollywood. She currently has a deal at Warner Media to produce film and TV, a new restaurant opening in South L.A., and a role in the 7th season of Black Mirror. You won't catch her wasting time. You probably won't catch her at all. Laura Wasser, The Negotiator. When your marriage is ending and you're famous, heartbroken, angry, and very, very rich, you call Wasser. An inspiration for Laura Dern's character in Marriage Story, Wasser has become one of the most sought-after divorce lawyers in L.A. Think Ariana Grande, Kim Kardashian, and Johnny Depp. And she has progressive ideas about what she calls the evolution of dissolutions. Jason Bateman, Will Arnett, and Sean Hayes, The Talking Heads. Amid a cluttered landscape of celebrity podcast that grows with each downturn in Hollywood day jobs, SmartLess is a singular and beloved bit of funny business that SiriusXM rewarded with a reported $100 million deal. These guys are so chaotic and goofy that they sometimes seem to forget there's a guest present. In the end, the show is an ode not to cluefulness or dogged research, but friendship. Michael Keaton, your favorite actor's favorite actor. The Batman, Birdman, Beetlejuice. Keaton has created unforgettable characters his entire career. He was only in the original Beetlejuice for 17 minutes, but the performance was so beloved that it spawned a sequel last year. Whether it's broad comedy, quiet devastation, or political advocacy, Keaton always makes it look organic and effortless. And Nicole Scherzinger, the showstopper. It's rare for a Broadway performance to go viral, but the striking image of Scherzinger as Norma Desmond in a black slip, covered in stage blood, has become a must-see for theater junkies this season. Scherzinger's revelatory turn in Sunset Boulevard represents a stunning return to the spotlight for the actor, and we all know how much Hollywood appreciates the power of a comeback. Thank you. vibe check. With 2024 in the rear view, high-ranking Democrats are finally arriving at the hard truth that their party is unwell. Disarray doesn't quite cover it. As for what they're doing about it, and whether they can ever wrest the country back from Trump and Trumpism, it depends on whom you ask. By James Pogue, with opening illustration by Brian Stauffer, which shows the party mascots all tied up. In balloon strings and about to float away. It was the hottest ticket in Chicago, designed to spawn 1,000 pieces about what the party meant. 2,000 people RSVP'd. I am not kidding when I say this is the best political party I've ever been to, the anti-gun youth activist David Hogue told a reporter. This is where Gen Z is. He was speaking at the Hotties for Harris event, held at a polished warehouse space midway through the Democratic National Convention last August. When I got there around midnight, a giant screen displaying floating images of Tim Walz's head and hundreds of free condoms reading F Project 2025 were scattered and discarded all over the floor. At least a couple hundred people were still dancing. Every third person was wearing one of those ubiquitous camouflage Harris Walz caps that had become an unlikely fashion item for Brown and Oberlin graduates working to elect a ticket that pundits and consultants seem to believe might capture a serious slice of votes from America's hunting and fishing dads. Democratic Party girls, as Claudia Conway, the 19-year-old daughter of George and Kellyanne Conway, described herself, and TikTokers with millions of followers, like Maddie Westbrook, had been invited by the score. Off to the back was a little purpose-built room with a display of free birth control, a wall of weirdos displaying photos of Republican officials, and a wall of so-called hotties who supported Harris, like Beto O'Rourke, Jason Kelsey, and Elizabeth Warren. Their portraits all framed and washed from overhead in the lime-green brat hue that seemed, at least for a little bit, like it might soon ride a wave of good feelings all the way to the Oval Office. Florida Representative Maxwell Frost, the youngest member of Congress, was standing quietly by the bar. He looked like he had partied himself out for the night. He replied monosyllabically as a couple of reporters tried to engage him. I turned and began speaking to a young woman who worked for a branding consultancy called Proper Daily, which had helped put the party on. She told me they'd been doing events like it around the country. We went to bars, gave out a lot of free ice cream, a lot of free Plan B, she said. She used the phrase content-driven strategy twice. We represent brands, celebrities, foundations, she said. There were a lot of creators coming to the DNC who didn't have much to do, so we decided we'd throw a party. I excused myself to go to the restroom and catch some fresh air. A security guard stood watch inside the men's room. I watched him block someone from going into a stall and caught his eye to inquire whether he was there to prevent people from going in to snort stimulants. He raised his eyebrows and gave as much of an answer as he could possibly have been allowed to give. What do you think? I stepped outside, hoping to bum a cigarette, and noticed that there wasn't a single person who'd come out for a smoke. These days, it would have been much more surprising to find a party full of young Republicans where no one was out smoking or with a chaperone in the bathroom to make sure nobody did drugs. Democrats had started looking, if not to themselves, then at least to much of the country, like our national party of rule followers and honor students. Republicans had begun to gleefully lean into the idea of their party as the home of outsiders. Party boys turned cabinet picks, and as the wall put it, weirdos. This shift has been more apparent online than in real life. But as Democrats had coalesced around a single-minded fixation, as a Democratic member of Congress put it to me later, on Donald Trump, and defending against the epical threat they believe he poses, the party had found itself in a trap. Democrats had brought together everyone from leftist to neoconservatives, a Sanders-Harris-Cheney coalition, as the Washington Post reporter Jeff Stein put it, in a popular front to defend democracy. But in an era when nearly 60% of Americans believed our democracy needed major changes, it looked to many voters like this coalition represented a well-off and well-educated establishment interested in preserving a status quo many regular Americans had come to despise. For the first time in modern history, the party would end up winning a majority of affluent voters and losing a majority of voters making less than $50,000 a year. Democrats, by dint of standing in opposition to a populist insurgency, had started to morph into what looked like America's establishment. For decades, Democrats contested national elections less by uniting voters around a shared political vision than by functioning as a coalition of regional and ethnic voting blocs thrown together in opposition to the interest of generally white, generally Protestant, asset-holding, comfortably bourgeois voters who tended to reside in the leafier precincts of the Northeast and Upper Midwest. The idea of the Democratic Party as the home of outsiders, set against this proper establishment, goes back to days long before left and right were meaningful dividing lines in American politics. It is in some ways the fundamental feature of the party's DNA. In contemporary history, even as a bipartisan establishment consensus came to shape both the style and substance of American politics, it tended to be Republicans who openly aligned with Chamber of Commerce types, our federal spy and security agencies, and our military commitments abroad. Now, Republicans of this stripe, from Liz Cheney to former Congressman Adam Kinzinger to former George W. Bush speechwriter David Frum, were loudly supporting the Harris-Walz ticket. The Democrats would soon face 4 years of playing rearguard defense for all those institutions of state and long-held political norms that Republicans have been cheerfully set to attack. I left and walked back toward Lake Michigan. I ended up at a Greek after-hours bar where a trio of drunken young Harris campaign staffers offered me a shot of Fernet Branca. What we mean when we call them weird, one very large young man sweating in a black suit told me, is that they're effing irresponsible people. Put that down. It's actually cool to be a responsible steward of an effing democracy. Two young women in floral print dresses gave a small cheer. That week, all the public talk at the convention was about joy, energy, and vibes. Few seemed aware that half the country was sensing the same energy pointing in the opposite direction. This is where real political power lies, Hoke had said back at the party. It's not in politics, it's actually in culture. Because when culture changes, politics change. The joy, energy, and unity are all now the stuff of sardonic jokes. The unity was obvious and real, but the energy was far more palpable on cable news than in the United Center, where the Chicago Bulls play their home games. Reporters complained constantly of being bored and spent long days slouched up in the cheap seats, trading tips on which senators might have availability that afternoon or where the good parties were. It hasn't exactly been what I hoped, a local volunteer wearing a big Teachers for Kamala button told me as we rode the L to the arena together. They want it to be a really sustainable event, so a big group of us have been on duty sorting compost from the trash. But I don't think I've missed much yet. and the joy manifested itself mostly as relief that President Joe Biden had dropped out and Democrats now had a fighting chance. The big-name speakers summoned a stern sense of mission. Barack Obama admonished the crowd that this is still going to be a tight race. Bernie Sanders came out to the old chants of Bernie, Bernie. The whole arena swelled, and the bitter animosities and fanatic energies of 2016 and 2020 seemed like very old history. Sanders gave a speech arguing that Biden, by leveraging the power of government toward a national industrial policy, anti-monopoly efforts, infrastructure, and climate, had been a more transformative president than many understood. Behind the scenes, Democrats argued several times to me that Biden actually represented our first post-neoliberal president. A figure who had marked a break with the trend toward financialization, globalization, and prioritization of markets and business interest above almost any other national interest that had shaped policymaking in both parties in the decades before 2016. I later dug up a short piece I remembered from this time titled "The Decorous Demise of the Establishment," which traced the end of the establishment consensus sometime around when Jeb Bush was forced out of the race for president. It is hard to imagine future generations of candidates returning to the same establishment style embodied by Mitt Romney and Jeb Bush, Mark Leibovich wrote in the New York Times Magazine, or going back to the same well of on-message orthodoxy. They won't spend tens of millions on ads enriching the same cast of consultants and operatives. But by 2024, Democrats had gone back to exactly this well of orthodoxy and even the same set of trusted campaign pros, like David Plouffe, to preach it. Can you run just an incredibly intensive presidential campaign as if you were running a dead-heat battleground state governor's campaign? He asked before the election, and I think we can. The great looming risk of a second Trump presidency had made party leaders visibly averse to risk of any other kind. Toward the end of his speech, Sanders raised a finger and wagged it in that faux hectoring way of his. "Let us be very clear," he said. "This is not a radical agenda." A couple of older women near me cheered, and a tentative swell of applause rose up in the arena before people seemed to realize this wasn't supposed to be an applause line. "Let me tell you what a radical agenda is," he said. "Trump's Project 2025. On the second night of the convention, I stopped at a small gathering at a lakeside franchise of Harry Caray's Steakhouse. I was looking to talk to Jamie Raskin. In the past few years, the Maryland congressman has taken roles on the House Special Committee investigating the January 6th riot and as the lead impeachment manager charged with prosecuting Trump for insurrection in his trial before the Senate. He has emerged, at least in the liberal media sphere, as a symbolic leader of the effort to defend America's institutional stability and constitutional order. Raskin was swarmed by a crowd of fans and hangers-on inside the bar, so I had a beer outside, chatting with a woman from Orange County, California, who owned a company that did something in the field of biotherapeutics. She caught the eye of Michael Cohen, the former Trump fixer turned inmate turned cable news bit player, who was hovering around, eagerly posing for selfies with everyone who approached him. "You're so brave," one woman wearing a number of chunky beaded necklaces told him. "I'm not brave," he said. "I just love my country." Cohen's demeanor changed when I told him I was a writer. "Call Maggie Haberman," he said, "or call, do you know Cuomo?" "All of them. They all have my number. Everyone calls me." A young guy in a white Oxford shirt was very interested to talk about a gap in energy and political vision between Democrats and Republicans. He had recently left a state-level position to take a job on the Harris campaign staff. "Democrats really just don't want to see there's a crisis," he said. a lot of us at least. I asked if he wanted to sit down and talk for a while, but he hurriedly shook his head. "Take my card," he said. "Let's stay in touch." "But I can't," he looked around. "You get it. I can't talk here." I was finding, much to my surprise, that Democrats at this convention were harder to convince to speak freely than Republicans, who may hate the media and regard us as an intelligence gathering arm working for an enemy power structure, but they're rarely boring. I explained to him I was looking to speak with Raskin to talk over this problem Democrats faced in suddenly looking like the party defending the status quo and institutions of state. I think this really is the core conversation in American politics now, the Harris staffer texted me later. I completely agree about how head-spinning it is to see the American right begin to own anti-blob arguments that used to be the provenance of the left. The blob is a term coined by Ben Rhodes, a former senior advisor to Obama, to describe the intractable nest of private and governmental interest that make up our national security establishment. Not so long ago, a thing Republicans rarely criticized. The staffer marveled at how prevalent this conversation is becoming in circles where it previously seemed kind of unthinkable. There was no way to get Raskin alone at the party where the crowd of admirers had not thinned at all in the time I'd been outside. So we met around 4 the next afternoon and traveled in a small entourage, very slowly, past the concession stands and roped off sections reserved for streaming influencers, stopping every 10 yards or so as another nervous pair of fans would approach to wish him well, thank him, and tentatively ask to shake his hand and snap a picture. We took a tightly guarded elevator up to a suite on the 8th floor in the rarefied VIP area housing skyboxes and executive suites. The actor Mandy Patinkin was in the hallway as we exited the elevator. He froze when he saw Raskin. He clasped his hand and held on to it as they talked. "I just want to thank you so much for everything you did on the committee," Patinkin said, "to put Trump away, hold him accountable for his insurrection." "I appreciate that," Raskin said. "I just want to know if there's anything I can do to help," Patinkin said. "Well, now you know you've got friends in low places on Capitol Hill," Raskin said. "Thank you." I waited for a while as Raskin did a spot with a trim 35-year-old streamer in a tight-fitting suit named Brian Tyler Cohen. I had never heard of him before, but he has 3.5 million followers on YouTube, and he'd just gotten word that his new book, Shameless, Republicans' Deliberate Dysfunction and the Battle to Preserve Democracy, had reached the top of the New York Times bestseller list. Raskin congratulated him, and the two did a friendly interview about how Trump had met his match in Harris. "You served on the January 6th committee," Cohen said. "As Donald Trump becomes more and more unhinged and desperate, it elevates the possibility of violence or danger in the same way that we saw the insurrection on January 6th, 2021. Does that worry you at all, the prospect of another insurrection?" "We have improved the physical defense of the Capitol against MAGA insurrectionists and so on," Raskin said. "We're ready for them." We sat in a pair of armchairs overlooking the floor as the New York Congressman Tom Suozzi spoke far below us. Raskin wore a formal gray suit with an incongruous pair of chunky white-soled sneakers, the same kind that left New York Times-style writer Guy Trebe despondent over the state of our establishment when Mitch McConnell, Hakeem Jeffries, and Kevin McCarthy turned up wearing them in an Oval Office meeting in 2023. Raskin, 62, is small in build, with a bit of a comb-over, but he conveys a gravity and command that must serve well in the setting of a televised congressional hearing. I explained I thought Trump had a good chance of winning, and that if he did, Raskin might soon be at the center of some very bitter battles. Steve Bannon had predicted that a second Trump administration would hit the Department of Justice with a blowtorch. Well, they assert a very strong version of the unitary executive theory, he said. It will be Donald Trump calling up the Attorney General and ordering him to do whatever Trump wants in terms of squashing investigation of someone who has given him the big campaign contribution or going after a perceived political enemy. That's a radical reversal of our understanding of the relationship between the president and the prosecutorial function. They're putting that at the center. Raskin was elected in 2016 with the help of Sanders-aligned PACs, and in his early years in Congress, he developed a reputation as a civil libertarian and skeptic of the so-called blob. But the Trump years and January 6th seemed to make him more sympathetic toward our internal security apparatus. Last April, Raskin reversed a position he'd taken on two procedural votes and ended up casting what amounted to the decisive vote to preserve the backdoor search loophole in the Foreign Service Intelligence Act, which allows federal agencies like the FBI and the National Security Agency to surveil the communications of American citizens in some circumstances without probable cause or a warrant. A power that has been used since the Bush administration to spy on dozens of racial justice protesters, a state judge, a professor, a sitting congressman, and a U.S. senator, and even a batch of 19,000 unsuspecting donors to a congressional campaign, according to a report from the Brennan Center for Justice. He understood where I was going. Let me first start with the domestic analogies to what you're saying, he said. In the Judiciary Committee, I spent many years sitting there while Jim Jordan and Matt Gaetz and all the right-wingers attacked the FBI. And they're attacking the FBI for one very simple reason, which is they were investigating Donald Trump. Raskin might have talked about his father at this moment. Marcus Raskin was a lefty policymaker and anti-war activist who was prosecuted, but not convicted, for aiding draft dodgers, and he was one of the first to receive documents that were eventually published as the Pentagon Papers. In 1976, two of Marcus's colleagues at the think tank he co-founded were murdered by a car bomb that agents of the U.S.-backed government of Augusto Pinochet had planted on D.C. streets. Now, as someone who is perfectly aware of the COINTELPRO program and the FBI surveillance and sabotage against the civil rights movement, I believe that the FBI should not be used as an instrument of political aggression, Raskin said to me now. So I was in the awkward position of having to defend the law enforcement objectivity of the FBI in terms of the Trump investigations. As far as we know, it has been operating in a completely objective law enforcement fashion, he said. So in the international context, we'd say the CIA was clearly involved and complicit in Pinochet's overthrow of the Allende government in Chile in 1973. That doesn't mean that the CIA is attacking Donald Trump. He resisted the idea that Democrats have become the party of the status quo. To the extent that we are going to derive a grand political philosophy, a new public philosophy, he said, it will be one that emerges from the very specific programmatic answers we come up with to deal with real-world crises, including climate change, including economic inequality, and including the kind of social polarization which is being promoted by the right wing. It's consistent with the tradition of American pragmatism, he said, arguing for a liberalism that could bring a revolution by increments. And pragmatism gets a bad name because people think pragmatism means just adjusting to political reality. That's not what it means. He referred back to John Dewey and William James, who had proffered pragmatism as America's natural political philosophy. It's the use of social experimentation to address widely felt social problems, he said. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.